So I was going through an old scrapbook just now from my summer as a 20-year-old intern at the Champaign-Urbana News Gazette. And this was the lead to a story I wrote headlined, "Hubber Hitters Take Their Cue from Snooker." Except for a Bob Dylan song playing dully in the background, the dark, smoky pool hall is dead quiet. A man decked out in a black Kiss shirt and ripped faded jeans pulls one last drag from the cigarette hanging from the edge of his lips. He chalks his stick and takes a final breath. Money sits on the edge of the table, and those surrounding the action hold their beer cans and stand motionless as this last shot will determine who gets the loot. It's a classic pool hall scene right out of The Color of Money, but there's a group of players in Gilman turning heads in another direction. On August 26, the Hubber Hitters, a seven-man pool team whose members hail from Gilman and Rantoul, will travel to Las Vegas to compete in the National Bud Light Pool League Championships. And it's not great. It's not even close to great. But as I was coming up, and as I still do today, I did not take stories off, ever. I tried and I tried and I tried to find a creative spark in everything I wrote. And if you're an aspiring journalist sitting here in 2023, you should 100% do the same. Because you never know what a future boss is looking for or perusing. So always bring your best, even if you're writing about the Hubber Hitters. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of 10 books and the host of Two Writers Sing and Yang, the podcast where one writer, me, talks writer with another writer every single week. And today's guest is Jean-Jacques Taylor, the longtime football writer and columnist and the author of the fantastic new book, Coach Prime, Deion Sanders and the Making of Men. This is episode number 336. Let's sing some Yang.
Dad, your podcast sucks and you're culturally irrelevant.
All right, Jean-Jacques Taylor, thank you so much for doing this. I feel like I should have had you on a long time ago. Our paths have overlapped many times involving the Cowboys and such. And yeah, first of all, thank you for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks, man. I appreciate it. As my mother would say, it don't seem like so long when it's over.
So I'm fascinated by something. You have a book coming out, or a new book out, called Coach Prime, Deion Sanders and the Making of Men. And there's something really old school about the ride-along book. One of the books when I was a kid, I just loved. The take you inside. The Sparky Lyle writing about the 1978 Yankees, and you're there and you're seeing it all happen. And we don't get them that much anymore. I know you wrote a story for SI that HarperCollins paid attention to and came to you and said, what about a book? Will you do this? What are the complications, if any, of getting not just a coach, but a program on board with you rolling with them for a year?
In this particular case, it wasn't all that complicated because I've known Deion since 1995 when he played for the Cowboys. We've had a close relationship throughout the years. And it was one of those deals where I might not talk to him every year, but if I talk to him, it's like, even if it's been a couple of years, it seems like we just talked the other day. And so literally when I called him and said, hey, I got this opportunity, what do you think? He's like, I got you, whatever you need, you got it. The interesting thing about how it turns out is because he gave me so much access, I really didn't even talk to him that much. Like, I was in Jackson from August until the end of December. And if I'm not mistaken, now, I think I had three or four sit downs with Dia. Three of the four were unplanned. You know what it is like to be a reporter, bro. You just hanging. And some days I would hang, and one day, well, hey, John, come on, let's talk. Okay. And you never know how long, or come take a ride with me. And you just go, and maybe it lasts an hour and a half, or maybe it lasts 20 minutes. You just don't know. So that, to me, was interesting things, that I had so much access, and I could go anywhere and do anything, that I really didn't need to talk to him all that much. And, you know, some of that is I sat in on production meetings, and so that was access. Even if I wasn't asking questions, per se, I could get to him then. But, like, real long, formal sit-downs, nah, three or four times.
I've always thought one of the complications of books like this is that they use the term flying a wall, right? You're flying a wall and you're observing. Right. But in a way, by the very nature of us being a fly on the wall, we're changing the dynamic to a certain degree oftentimes because athletes are aware, well, this guy's writing a book or this guy's doing an article. So are we really flies in the wall or are we spit in the soup where we add something to it? And I ask you, were you a fly on the wall or is that the wrong sort of way of thinking of this kind of thing?
The way I did it, a lot of times I really was a fly on the wall. Sometimes I was, how'd you term it, spit in the soup? When Deion's at a team meeting or there's a function or something like that and I'm there, I really am a fly on the wall because he ain't changing for me. And the responses and the reactions that he's getting from people, they certainly aren't changing for me because they all focused on him. Because what I tried to do as much as you can is not be obtrusive. So if I'm sitting in on a quarterback's meeting, I might slide in and sit in the back. If I'm at an offensive line meeting, I might get there with everybody else, but I'm always in the back. I'm always off to the side. The players would hold their own meeting, defensive players, on Friday nights. I'd get in there. I'd sit way in the back. And see, here's the other thing, man. I was around so much that they got used to seeing me so much that I just became just, you know, part of the furniture. And so I didn't really stick out that much. And then, of course, when you say, hey, I need to holler at you, okay, now, you know, you're not so much a now you're involved and people know you're there. And, you know, a couple of times coaches were like, hey, you know, we got Taylor here. What story is he going to write about this team and this game? Y'all need to. And so, okay, well, now I'm spitting the soup. But that didn't happen too often.
I wrote a book about the 90s Cowboys. This is an example. There are some scenes in the book. Example, Charles Haley masturbating under a towel in team meeting. If that were a 18-year-old, 19-year-old college kid, if I were doing that book about the Jackson State football team, I would not use that. I'm not going to do that about some 19-year-old kid. And it is fascinating because you're flying the wall, but you're flying the wall for kids who are mostly under 21 years old. I don't know. You hear some kid go, man, I can't wait to fuck my bitch tonight, blah, blah, blah. Or I can't wait to so-and-so. Like, oh man, I just want to get wasted with blah, blah, blah. And he's 19. Like, do you have to be cognizant that these are, even if they are not legally kids, that they are still kids, young people finding their way in the world?
Well, here's the thing, just the way I operate. The reason I've been a successful reporter is just to go back for a minute to my beginnings. When I was covering the Cowboys initially, I literally went from covering high schools and being the backup number two guy on the Rangers for parts of two seasons, not even a whole season, to covering the Cowboys, the most highest profile team in sports next to, you know, in there with the Yankees and the Lakers. And so I really wasn't ready for the job, although I wanted the job. And so I've been on the beat, man, for like a year when I got that, hey, let's have lunch from your boss. And I remember asking, hey, is this a business lunch or is this just lunch? He's like, oh, no, it's just lunch. And then I got there and it turned into a business lunch. And it was basically, if you don't start breaking some stories, we're going to move you off the beat. And at that particular time, I'm calling my friends like Mike Freeman. I'm like, dude, how you break stories? Man, you just got to work. Dog, I'm working. And I called my other friends, hey, how you break story? You just got to work, man. And I'm like, I'm working. And so what I decided to do, I made a very conscious choice that I'm going to get cats, because this was the Cowboys now in the mid-90s. They had a lot of guys who didn't talk.
Yeah.
All those cats who don't talk, I'm going to get them to talk to me. And that's going to be my niche that, oh, you can't take me off the beat because I'm the only one who get Leon Lett to talk. I'm the only one who get Charles Haley to talk. I'm the only one to get Eric Williams to talk. I'm going to make myself that guy. So what I'm telling you is I've always been a guy who understood how to get relationships and how to get people to say things. But in doing so, you have to earn their trust. And by earning their trust, you have to understand like, okay, this thing I can run with, this thing I need to say, hey, check this out. Are you sure you want to say this? Because if you say this, it's going to make you look like this. You don't do that in every instance, but you do that in certain instances. And so there are a few times with players where I was like, you don't want to say that, dog. Let me ask you this and come at it in a different way. Now, the one thing I put in the book that wasn't like that was Quay Davis. He was a receiver from Dallas who actually went to my high school. So I kind of followed his high school career, and I know him pretty well. And he's a good kid, but a troubled kid. Not a bad dude at all. But he fathered four kids before he left high school. So that's his background. Come from a very rough neighborhood, all of that stuff. And so he came to me in the cafeteria and he's like, I'm tired of this. My teammates let me down. They let me oversleep. I was late for a meeting. Now coach is on me. I just quit, man. And he just went off on a tirade and a vent. I just let it roll. And I put all that in the book because all along I had kind of showed he was this talented guy who could never quite get his talent on the field to do what he's supposed to do. And at one point, I think I wrote, he's venting to me and he's talking so much, it's like he's talking out loud, like he wants to hear if this vent and this rant makes sense. And when I was thinking about it as he was saying, I was like, okay, he's dropping a lot of buff F-bombs and 12-letter cuss words and this or that, but much of it is directed at him and directed at his, at a group of teammates he's mad at, as opposed to one guy. Okay, I'm gonna ride with that. And I thought about it before I put it in. And because Deion let me stay on the sideline, okay, again, he trusts me. So I got to use some like strategic things on the sidelines. Okay, that's fine. But, you know, sidelines get heated. You just have to, you know, filter what's real and what's not. And then because you're doing a book, you can always go back a couple weeks later and say, hey, this happened. What was going on in there? And you get more context. And you can rewind it like that. That's kind of how I tried to do it.
With a kid like Davis, he's obviously had a rough life, and talking to you in a very volatile moment for him and a troubled moment for him. Do you let him know you're going to use it in the book? And if not, do you kind of worry about him a month from now being like, yo, what the fuck?
No, because when I talk to cats, I pretty much, when they came to me, we're talking, it's going in the book. I mean, most of these guys, when you talking to me, when you come to me, when you come to me. Well, as a matter of fact, I was a little surprised that they would be so excited to talk. But they were all excited to talk. And one of the things I enjoyed most real talk about the book is and this thing I enjoy most about being a reporter is I literally asked him everything. Like when Nas Gaddy gets suspended for the game, dog, I'm asking him every single solitary question about why'd you do this and why'd you do that and your girlfriend did this and that. And they're giving you answers because they want their voice and their side of the situation out there. Now, we both know as reporters, everybody's got revisionist history, depending on how you think it makes you look. But I feel real comfortable. I didn't do that. And here's the other real talk is I had a great editor, Rakia Clark at HarperCollins, because she flagged me on a couple of things. She's like, I don't know if we want to write this because that's so sensitive. These are young kids. And, you know, when somebody brings that to my attention, I step back. I got a son who's 19. I go, okay, let me see. If my son would say something like that, how would I handle it? I made adjustments and either rewrote around it or took it out or did whatever she thought was best in a certain situation, because the idea is not to make anybody look bad. The idea is to tell the truth and tell all sides of the truth so that people have context. You know, I told Deion this several times. I go, it's not really for me to make you look good or say you're this or say you're that. It's to lay out an honest look at your football program. I think it's doing good things, but lay it out honestly and then let people decide whether they think you're a charlatan or whether they think you're a good dude or a good coach or whatever.
Do you get people who view him as a charlatan?
I get it just a little bit, but I always say, because I don't try to convince people Deion is this or that, because that's like trying to convince any other person that people either love or any other polarizing figure. Stephen A. Smith, dog, people either love Stephen A. or they hate Stephen A. You're not going to convince them otherwise. I get it a little bit, but and part of it is I've known him for a long time. If you just look at his work, his body of work, and I use this as the example. My son went to his football camp when he was 7. I would drop my son off at the football camp probably about 7 o'clock in the morning. And Deion would be there, and Kevin Mathis, who's on his staff right now, would be there. Andre Hart, who's on his staff now, would be there, and a few other guys would be there. I'd drop him off, and because I knew those guys, because they had played for Dallas, I'd go up and drop him off, and, hey, what's up, dog, blah, 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 dap up, talk 5 minutes, I'm on my way. When I went back to pick my dude up at like 6 o'clock, Deion would still be there. Kevin Mathis would still be there. All those guys would still be there. Now, you got to understand. I know for Deion, for a fact, he was driving an hour, maybe a little bit more than an hour, in morning traffic to get there. And when he was leaving, he was driving maybe 55 minutes to get back. That's not most pro athletes that I know who put on camps. And he did that all day, all summer. And so I use that as the basis of saying, when he tells you he's into kids, he's into kids. He can kind of come off in a certain way because when the primetime switch hits, you get the charismatic primetime character. When he's not primetime, he's a much different dude.
Well, you wrote something that really fascinated me, and this is page 139. You wrote, Coach Prime started each team meeting with a prayer. He'd walk into the meeting room, remove his hat, usually a baseball cap, and say, "Somebody pray us up." Normally, a player immediately stood and led a team in a brief prayer. Sometimes a coach did it. Coach Prime never did it. It's important to him that his players do it. After several weeks of the same few players leading the prayer each morning, Coach Prime asked different players to do it. Toward the end of the season, he asked two or three players each morning to pray, ensuring each player did it at least once. "It's important because these guys are going to have families one day," he said, "and they're going to have to lead their families. Sometimes they're going to have to pray about something and they need to know how to do it." He also wanted to show players there's no right way to speak to God. You can call him Father, Man, or Almighty, depending on your relationship. Coach Prime wanted them to know that they didn't have to use religious language like thee or thou. They could speak to God the way they talk to their friends. And I have to say, as like an atheistic, agnostic Jew, one of the things I've struggled with Deion Sanders, coaching at two public universities, not just prayer, but the references to Jesus and God is great and Jesus is great and we're going to pray. What am I missing there?
You know, the other part is that he had an agnostic on his team, a guy who's agnostic, a guy named Donald, a guy who had been in the Marines. So he was older. He was like 28. You know, I had a great talk with him about how he handled it. And the thing he said was, and it's a very, 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 which is an awful word because it really gives you nothing, but it's the most nuanced of nuanced conversation, because God and religion is clearly very important to him. But it's not like he hits you over the head with it all the time as a team. He says that, and then he doesn't really refer to it. I don't know, man. He really uses these biblical stories and these parables that he uses and these examples that he uses, not so much to get you to be a Christian, but to get you to be a better person or to get you to do things in a certain way. And here's what I mean. I went to a non-denominational church for a long time. I put my kid in a school at the non-denominational church. And I put him in there because I wanted him to have a foundation, kind of morals and what's right and what's wrong. And I took him out of it going into the sixth grade because I said, "Hey, dog, at some point you got to know when somebody step on your foot, they're not going to say, 'I'm sorry, Jesus loves you.' You got to get to the real world and understand that, hey, man, what are you looking at? And somebody push you that, you know, that the real world is out there." And so I think he tries to use it as a base of which to operate with. But it's nuanced because he doesn't come off as like preachy and you need to follow me and do exactly what I do. Because I asked him about it, like, you know, you got some other religions in there. And that particular year, there was just one other. There was the agnostic guy and just one other guy. But, you know, obviously, as more you go through it, you'll find other religions.
Sure.
And like he asked one kid, Tyler, he said, "Why are you crossing yourself? What does that mean?" And so he's very open to hearing about things. And so it doesn't seem so heavy handed when you're in it. That's the best way to explain. Although I had a great talk, several great talks with my editors about this, because they had the same questions you had. And she was like, we got to make sure we explain this and talk about it and show how he's using it, how he's working it, you know, because I'm going to say he talks about religion a lot without sounding preachy, if that makes sense. Like, and here's what I mean. Dabo Swinney talks about religion, but he sounds preachy to me.
Yes.
Deion talks about it, and it's more like, "Hey, Jeff, this is how you can be a better man. If you follow these principles, it'll help you be a better man." You kind of have to be around it. And I've talked to several players, because a lot of kids in the Black community, their grandmama took them to church, their mama took them to church, but they're not really in church. They're going because their grandmama took them, not because they want some deeper understanding of God. And to me, that's why it was important for him to say, "You don't have to be all that." You know, I didn't grow up in a church. And so I had a lot of these issues that they, like, when it's time to pray at Thanksgiving and it comes to you, "Well, what? I don't have a Bible verse. What am I supposed to say?" He can teach you that it's okay to say, "Hey, man, thank you for giving me breath today." Matter of fact, I got a workout partner. I got two of them, but one of them, we pray after every workout. And one of them, he says, "Man, thanks for waking us up this morning. Thanks for giving us breath in our lungs, man. We're going to try to do our best for you today." And he talks to God like he's his homeboy. He calls him man all the time because that's his relationship. And my other guys, you know, Father Jesus, da, 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 he's much more formal. And so every morning I get the two mixes. And it's interesting. And that's kind of how Deion is.
You and I have something in common, which is we both have written Jackson State-based books. I wrote Walter Payton's biography about a decade ago. You wrote the Deion Sanders book. And I would say in my reporting career, the two American cities that have had the greatest impact on me as a person are Gary, Indiana and Jackson, Mississippi. As a white guy who grew up in upstate New York in a mainly white community, you go to Jackson, Mississippi, you go to Gary, Indiana, and you think about all the mainly white people in America who say, everyone has a fair shot in this country. That's the beauty of America. And I always say, go to Gary, Indiana, go to Jackson, Mississippi, and tell me that the people in the schools there, the kids growing up there, have the same shot that you had growing up in suburbia. Spending time in Jackson, Mississippi, throwing yourself into Jackson, Mississippi, what did you sort of get out of that city?
Number one, it wasn't as bad as I thought. That doesn't mean it was good. It wasn't as bad as I thought. I got stopped for driving while black the second night I was there. Now that, and so I was like, so is this how it's going to be the whole time?
Right.
You know, because, and I say I got stopped driving for while black because I had a white Camaro that was convertible with some new tags on it because it was only a couple months old or whatever. And I got stopped and I was like, I had slowed down because I seen him. And so I was just like, I hadn't really committed. I don't even think I got a ticket. That's why I said drive while black. And I was just like, is this how it's going to be? And I found it that it wasn't. My experience is it wasn't. And I was very surprised that of all the black people I talked to in Jackson, not a lot of people talked about overt racism, which made me think so much more of it is systemic and stuff like you can't get any money for funding your school programs and stuff like that, as opposed to, you know, kind of the overt stuff you would think coming from the 60s. It wasn't nearly as bad as I thought, but, you know, I was also down there during the water crisis, man. So I was staying at an Airbnb where you couldn't flush the toilet. Basically, the whole time I was there, you had to drop, you know, water in the tank every time.
Like, can you tell the story of Deion Sanders, not just at Jackson State, but leaving Jackson State, and not talk about sort of the city and the university and the circumstances that they are kind of enveloped in?
It's all one in the same. I mean, it's all combined and it's all linked up together. And, you know, to me, he did a lot of good things in the city, but he didn't stay long enough to really impact the city. Meaning if he had stayed a couple more years, they could have got some things that would have lasted long beyond him done, but they didn't. And so, you know, I mean, like even now, and the biggest stark in contrast is last year or 2022 at the spring football game is 60,000 people. I mean, it's like a regular season game. I went this year and there's barely 1,000. He didn't stay there long enough to really get everything entrenched. And so much like when Bill Parcells left the Cowboys, I mean, he told some people privately, within 2 years, there'll never be any trace that I was here. And I would say within 2 or 3 years, there's not going to be very much trace that Deion Sanders was ever at Jackson State.
Wait, that's such a fascinating thing, because there was this moment, obviously you were there for it, when Eddie Robinson Jr., the coach at Alabama State, basically says, you're not SWAC. And Deion Sanders says, I am SWAC. And I remember thinking, and this is not an indictment of Deion Sanders, you're not really SWAC. Like you're there and you're visiting, but there are Eddie Robinson, but you know, like there are guys who live it and ooze it. Is it a fair criticism to say to Deion Sanders, this city needed you, this university needed you, they needed a long-term commitment, this is a place that's struggling, these are people that's struggling, you gave them a taste of the prime rib, and then you took it to Colorado, a place where they already had plenty of prime rib? Like, is that a...
I don't think so, because I don't think it's a fair criticism, because number one, real talk, how long is long enough? 2.5 years is short, yeah. But how long is long enough? Do I need to stay 5? Do I need to stay 7? Do I need to stay 10? You're going to be mad at me whenever I leave, if I leave on a successful note. Number two, any relationship that you're in, business relationship, personal relationship, did I leave the relationship better than I found it? If I'm dating you and we break up, did I leave you better than I found you? Did you leave me better than you found me? And if the answer is yes, then I think it was a good relationship. It could be a good relationship that had a bad ending, but if you look back at the relationship and you're honest, says a man who's been married twice, did I leave you better off than I found you? And I would say, Yeah. And so it's really hard to get a good ending. I mean, there's only so many John Elway storybooks. They just don't happen. Had he and the president gotten along better, he would have stayed longer, I think, because, you know, Dion, the criticisms I have of Dion, and I've told him this, so I'm not saying anything I haven't told to him, and even he doesn't know, the man has no patience at all. But I get that. Why? He's rich and he's powerful, and he's been rich and powerful for 30 years. And so he has a single-minded focus that's unreal. And my point is, if you make him lose focus or you distract him from whatever his goal is, then he just kind of eliminates the goal because he doesn't like distractions. And if the president becomes a distraction and you're stopping me from doing the things that I need to do to win, then I open myself up to other opportunities. I really thought he was going to stay till Shadur graduated or Shadur left. 4 years, Shadur's gone. Let me see what else is out there. We've won a couple championships. We've kind of done everything we could do at this level. Let me see what else is out there. But his relationship with the president accelerated all of that. And so that's how he ended up in Colorado.
Do you feel like at Jackson State now, I don't know the answer to this, people look at him fondly or people look at him like, what the hell?
That's the classic Deion question. Have people love him? And they're like, hey, thanks for the memories. Thanks for the great time. You put us back on the map. You showed us what's capable of happening at Jackson State. And then the other half are like, you dirty dog. I can't believe you left. You know, we had a good thing here. You weren't really all about us. You were really all about yourself. Because I talked to some people from Jackson the other day. And I go, what's the mood down there? And they go, some people love him. Some people hate him. And he's okay with that, I think.
Before we continue with Two Writers Slinging Yang, a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, this is Jeff Perlman, and I'm here with my daughter, Casey. And what is that on your ankle?
It's a tattoo of a boot.
You got a tattoo of a boot on your ankle? Young lady, you're only 19 years old.
Dad, calm down. It's not just any boot.
I am so angry.
Dad, it's the kicking shoe worn by Garrett Lindholm, kicker for the 2011 Milwaukee Mustangs of the Arena Football League. I wanted to let people know they can go to royalretros.com and buy a hand-stitched, made-with-love Mustangs jersey.
Ugh, did you really have to get a tattoo to do this?
The butt-piercing pavilion was closed.
You covered the Dallas Cowboys for a long time, and the first coach you covered with the Dallas Cowboys, just speaking of quirky coaches, was Barry Switzer. I remember working on that book, Boys Will Be Boys, going to visit Barry Switzer in Oklahoma. He was sitting behind the big desk that he used at the University of Oklahoma. He now had it in his office in his home and being charmed beyond belief, like loving Barry Switzer, loving the way he talked, loving his mannerisms, just everything about him. What was it like covering Barry Switzer?
I'm trying to find the right word. I'd say really wild. And that's because it was my first taste of the NFL. You know, the weird thing about this, man, I tell people this all the time. That 95 season, covering the Cowboys, going to the Super Bowl, I was really so lost and so overwhelmed. I don't really have a lot of memories from that season because it was just a huge blur. But what I remember is the thing about Barry is you could ask him anything and you didn't have to worry about getting cussed out and yelled at and all this other stuff. Now, he might get terse, but it wasn't like a Jimmy Johnson experience or a Bill Parcells experience. And so for me, being a young reporter at the time, that was a good way to get introduced to the NFL because you could kind of make mistakes with your questions and your protocol and not have to pay the ultimate price. But I like Barry, and I saw Barry probably, it's probably about a year ago. And gave me a good handshake, we had a good talk. And so he's still a great dude. I mean, he's 80-something now, but he's sharp. And he still gets it.
Wait, it is actually crazy, 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 crazy that your first major beat was the Dallas Cowboys. And not just the Cowboys, but the Aikman, Emmett, Irvin, Barry Switzer, Jerry Jones Cowboys. And you're this kid in your early to mid-20s taking on this beat. Did you have any clue whatsoever what you were doing?
No, but I wasn't supposed to. Now, I stayed in school a long time. I didn't graduate from Ohio State until I was a couple weeks shy of being 25.
Okay.
And here's why. I decided I didn't want to go work in a small city. And when I was coming out of school, your natural thing was go work in a small city, do everything, learn everything. I grew up in Dallas, and I just could not see myself in a small city. And so I decided I was going to take internships and build my resume up in hopes that I wouldn't have to do that. And so luckily, my first job was the Dallas Morning News. And so I had a lot of experience writing. I just didn't have a lot of experience dealing with the personalities. And then throw on top of that, I was a Cowboys fan growing up. I mean, a huge Cowboys fan. And so for me, that cold water, welcome to the NFL thing was the first time one of the guys you looked up, you know, either cussed you out or, you know, acted an ass. And you're like, oh, let me put my fandom, my pom-poms down. This is like the real world. And so it was wild because I had to turn, it probably took me a full year to turn it off because I'm still starstruck. Like, damn, that's Troy Aikman. I'm hanging out with Michael Irvin. I mean, it was just wild. But it's a great experience because nothing can compare to that in terms of, like, you work that locker room, you're not intimidated going anywhere else. You're not afraid to go ask somebody else a question or do this or do that because there are probably some equally bigger teams, but nobody's bigger than the mid-90s Cowboys.
Did you have a moment, like that wake-up moment where you're like, oh, I have to cover these guys. These aren't heroes to me. These are people who are can be assholes.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a few of them. It's just because they had a lot of surly dudes at the time. But, you know, I had Charles Haley basically chase me out of a locker room. I think Eric Williams at one point before we got to be cool was like, shut the fuck up. I ain't got nothing to say. I mean, it was just crazy, man, because they were still having, you had to ask questions about guys getting suspended. And so how do you broach that topic? But my real welcome to the league moment and understanding that this is not a game and that this is serious for people. My first partner on the beat was Ed Wharton. And now the player was not that big a deal, but they were having some problems. And so they were like, hey, I forget the guy's last name now, but big center, fat guy. And they're like, they're trying to sign him. I got to go do something tonight. Your job is to go call the agent and make sure that they do sign this guy. So I did like any young reporter. I called him. He didn't answer. I called him again an hour later. He didn't answer. So Werder calls me about 10:30 and he goes, hey, did you ever get the agent? I go, nope. Called him a couple times. He never picked up. He said, then how the fuck did I get him? I said, oh. He said, you got to call him till you get him. I mean, he just went off on me. And I was like, all righty then. But it's a very valuable lesson that if you're supposed to get somebody, you know, you basically just call them till you get them. I mean, you can stop at midnight or 1 o'clock or something, but you basically have to call them, you know, until you get them. And 10:30 was, or I think I quit calling it like 9:30. That was not early enough to call.
Yeah, and that's a game-changing moment for a reporter.
Yeah. Real quick, I told, at a young cat I was mentoring, he was covering the Vikings, and Mike Zimmer was interviewing for the job. And I said, do you know where they put guys up when they come in to interview? He goes, yeah. I said, well, go to the hotel, get you a seat, face it toward the lobby, and hang. He said, how long should I hang? I said, till he gets there. He says, well, our deadline is it. I said, hang until he gets there. He said, well, what if he doesn't come till 1 a.m? I said, then your ass will be there till 1 a.m. And so this dude got him. I said, because at that point, whatever he says is news. And so you'll get it. He called me the next day, and he's like, hey, he got there at 1:30 a.m. And all I said was, are you here for the job? He said, yeah, we'll see how it goes tomorrow. I said, I told you, whatever you said was news. And I got in the elevator and went off. But he stayed there till 1:30, you know, making sure that he got it. And that's because Ed Werder told me 20 years earlier, you don't stop until you go get him.
Is it hard to maintain that level of passion and intensity for covering sports? Like, it's one thing when you're 27 and you're waiting in the lobby till 1 a.m. Is it hard at this point to still muster that?
Well, that's why I became columnist. No, for real. I told the morning news after I'd been doing it for 11 years, like, dog, I can't do this no more. Because I call it like being an athlete. You know it's time to retire as an athlete when what? You don't want to do the same preparation to make yourself be the player that you've always been. So if you're going to cover a beat like the Cowboys, I'm just exaggerating now, but it requires 100 phone calls to agents every week. Like, hey, Jeff, what's up, doc? Da, da, da. I got tired of the small talk. So what happens when you make 50 calls? Well, at some point you start getting beat. And my ego was such that I didn't want to get beat. So yeah. I had to make the calls. And so the only way I could stop making the calls was, y'all got to make me a columnist or I got to bounce. I can't do this at the level I'm used to doing it no more. I couldn't cover a beat the way I covered it then. I mean, it just would just beat you down because it was as competitive as anything in the country. And so to win, and I had to win, I mean, you just have to do whatever you got to do. Like Sean Payton, when he got the Saints job, I stayed in the parking lot 4 hours waiting for him because I saw his car. I said, okay, I know you're in the building. And I stayed 4 hours waiting for him to come out the building, sitting in my car, you know, before we had cell phones to really do what they do now. So that was just me listening to the radio. He came out. Hey, Jack, I can't talk to you. I said, okay, you got to give me something, dog. I spent 4 hours. Help me word this so I can, we can both be happy. And so we worked out something. I said, is this good? Okay, so I got the story. So now my 4 hours are worth it. But I did that numerous times, man. Just, that's just what is required to be good.
Well, I just want to say two things. Number one, I vividly remember because I went to University of Delaware. You mentioned Mike Freeman. Mike Freeman was a few years older than me at Delaware. I think he was 6 years before me. And I remember him coming back to a sports writing class and literally talking about waiting in the parking lot for Joe Montana for probably 4 hours and getting that thing. And we were all like, oh, 4 hours, Joe. And he's like, you got to do it. And the other thing I think is interesting is telling the guy, look, I've been waiting for 4 hours. You got to give me something. I think a lot of reporters wouldn't do that. And I think it's the smartest play is playing to their sympathy and just any sense of empathy. Yeah. Look, I'm this pathetic reporter. I've been sitting in the parking lot for 4 hours. Can you fucking cut me a break?
I don't know if you remember Mark Tuinei, the Cowboys left tackle Pro Bowl, died of a heroin overdose.
Of course.
He was with a guy named Nikki Sualua, who had been a fullback at Ohio State. I'm a Buckeye, went to Ohio State. So I had a great relationship with Nikki. I stayed outside Nikki's house the day he went to his grand jury, 8 hours waiting for him to come home. Met him in his driveway and said, we got to talk, man. And he said, we do? I said, yeah, we do. And went to his house and he gave me the whole story from start to finish about what happened the night Tuinei died.
I know you went to Ohio State, you knew him, but are you at all worried that like here he is at one of the lowest moments of his life? He sees you waiting outside his house and he punches you in the nose or he's like, go fuck yourself or what the fuck?
No, because here's my deal, man. This is real talk. Is the way I've always believed this. If you create real relationships, not fake ones, real relationships with people, and they can be athletes. If you create real relationships, then they don't believe you have an agenda. Like, I created a real relationship with Ron Washington, the former Rangers manager. Yeah. So when he got suspended for cocaine use, I call him. I said, duh. I got to kick your ass in the paper tomorrow. What's the best way for us to do that? And then I started asking him all these questions. And he doesn't think I have an agenda, so he's giving me honesty. Next day, he said, motherfucker, you kicked my ass. I said, I told you I was, but we good. Because I said, you know, this is the only thing we can do, man, because you fucked up. You know, it's not the end of the world, but I got to tell the truth on it.
You're convincing people you don't have an agenda. Fair. But don't you kind of have an agenda?
Well, let me put it like this. You have an agenda to get the story. The story coming out, man. You can either put your spin on it or you can get your side of the story out or you can not. I'm going to write what I'm going to write. I would prefer to know what you were thinking, what you were going through, what your emotions were, what your feelings were. Or I can just guess. The story going to get done. You can help or you can not help. I'm good either way. But, you know, I'm going to give you a fair shot because I'm going to keep it real with you. I used to tell cats this all the time. You'll never open up a paper and be, I can't believe he wrote this because I'm going to ask you about it. And then you can say whatever you want to say.
Well, you wrote something about Washington. I really like. You wrote a column after he was done as a Rangers manager. And you said the players will miss Washington more. And not just because he was one of the few people who could use a certain 12-letter curse word as a noun, verb, and adjective multiple times during a single conversation. They miss him because he arrived at the ballpark each day with the same toothy grin and positive energy, whether the Rangers led the division or were 31 and a half games behind the Angels. If players wanted to talk to Washington, all required was a short walk down the hallway and a knock on the door to give him enough time to spray air freshener so the smell from a recently lit cigarette wouldn't offend. Guys like Ron Washington, who I loved, was there a way you were able to forge a relationship with him that maybe other writers couldn't? Is it a matter of establishing time, establishing connections?
You got to understand, there's some benefits to being a Black reporter. There's some drawbacks to being a Black reporter. I said to myself, oh, the Rangers hired a Black manager? Oh, so they trying to introduce him around town. Literally, every event he went to, probably for the first 6-7 weeks he was the manager, your boy was there. And so after the event, what do? You small talk. Sometimes it's 5 minutes. Sometimes it's 25 minutes. And then you tell him, hey, I'm going to keep it real with you. If you'll explain the game to me, I'll make sure that all your thought processes come out. I don't have to agree with them, but teach me the game. Let me work with you. And I'm going to keep it real. If y'all suck, you suck. If you make a bad move, a question move, you make it. But I always ask you why you did it. I don't have to agree with it, but I can ask you why you did it. And we just got to forge a relationship from there. And so a lot of times, man, I would ask him questions and I wasn't writing anything. I was curious about the game. And why you do this? Why would you leave? This dude, one of the best things he ever told me, I said, because he got crushed. I can't remember who it was. It was a left-hander, couldn't hit lefties. It was a key moment in the game. He left him in there, lefty, and got struck out or whatever. He just got crushed. I said, Dawg, why you leave him in there? And he's like, it's not always about today. Yeah, he can't hit lefties, but he had two good swings in his first two at-bats. And I said, if this motherfucker gets a hit right here, he might go on a tear for the next 3 or 4 weeks hitting lefties. Now I can use him. He didn't. So, you know, I got to get my ass kicked by these motherfuckers who don't know what I'm thinking about. Yeah. But that kind of stuff does what? Allows me to go to that player and say, hey, man, what that mean for you to let you get that third at bat against a lefty? I'm sorry I let him down, blase, blase, blase. And then what does that also do? Allows me to build a connection with that guy. I'm going to tell you this because you can probably appreciate this. One of my favorite stories is Milton Bradley showed up in Texas.
He just came up in a podcast episode with Jason Reed.
You know, Milton has like the worst reputation of all time.
Yes.
Like the worst guy, an asshole, just, you know, the worst reputation. But Wash is his guy. And so I literally walked up to him in the clubhouse in spring, Surprise, Arizona. I literally walked up to him and said, you know, because he saw me coming and he's like, I'm not tough. I said, hey, dog, check this out. I said, Wash is my motherfucker. That makes you my motherfucker by default. I'll holler at you tomorrow. And I turned and left. And he just kind of looked at me like, and so the next day I showed up. I said, hey, what's up, dog? And he was cool. I may have been the only dude who had a great relationship with Bill Brad. And it's because I used my relationship with Wash to kind of create that thing. And then, you know, then you go into, why you got such a bad reputation? Well, the reporters did that. I said, dog, I ain't gonna never write nothing about you before I come ask you about it. How about that? All right, cool. I said, you ain't always gonna like it, but I ain't gonna never write it unless I ask you about it. Now, if you don't give me no answer, you're gonna leave me to my own devices. He said, no, I got you. And so that's how I started that.
Could I, as a white reporter covering the Texas Rangers, have gone to Milton Bradley and said, Wash is my motherfucker, now you're my motherfucker too, I'll hit you tomorrow?
If you got swag when you said it, if he believed it was authentic, because you got to say it right. It's my right. Motherfucker. You can't say, hey, you're my motherfucker. You can't do it. It got to be authentic. If it's authentic, yeah, you can do that.
And let me ask you a follow-up on that. Coach Prime, Deion Sanders in The Making of Men. Could a white reporter have done the same fly on the wall, HBCU, Deion Sanders, you know, 98% black roster, black coaches? I mean, a real sort of black empowerment moment in college football, in my opinion. Could a white reporter have been the fly on the wall and done it in a similar fashion?
Yeah. And I'm going to say this because you'll know this person. Mm-hmm. Michael Silver could do that, you know, but it has to be you. It has to be somebody who's used to being around black people, who's comfortable around black people, who understands their language, who understands how they get down, how they move. And if you're authentic about it, it's really who you are. Then, yeah, that's why I said Michael Silver could do it. I mean, hell, that's how he worked for Sports Illustrated all the years. What does every Michael Silver story start? In the club somewhere, at the restaurant somewhere, me and so-and-so hanging out somewhere. That's what he do. So, yeah, he could do that because that's who he is. And so if that's who you are, then you could do that. You know, I'm a relationship person, so I go out and figure out how to create relationships. It's not everything I do is intentional. That doesn't make it phony. It just means I want a relationship with you. It's like if you see the woman that you want, I want a relationship with you. Everything I do is intentional to create and foster and form that relationship. It's the same thing being a reporter. I want a relationship with the star quarterback. Everything I do is intentional to create that relationship. Don't mean it's phony. It's intentional. And maybe it gets created, maybe it doesn't. But I try to do it because that's what the business is. It's about relationships And the more you can foster them and create them and then use them, you know, the better off you'll be. And I mean, use them in a win-win situation as much as you can be. Or as I like to say, I just like to tell the truth, man. You can never go wrong telling the truth. The truth is not always pretty. But even when you criticize athletes, athletes know when they play bad. It ain't no surprise to them. So if you criticize their performance, hey, his slider was a little flat today. He hung too many over the plate. I mean, they're not going to get mad. Now, they don't have to like it, but okay, fine. Why was your slider flat today, Jeff? You know, I didn't have my arm most. Okay, boom, 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 boom. You good.
Let me ask you a final, final question. It's my required question of this podcast. What is your best confrontation ever with a player, coach, manager, owner, et cetera?
Oh, you know what, man? Rick Honeycutt threatened to kill me, and Jose Canseco was holding him back. It was my first road trip ever covering the Rangers. I went to Kansas City. Kevin Kennedy was the manager, and they lost. I can't remember the exact circumstance, but they lost a heartbreaker, and Rick Honeycutt had walked a bunch of people, like five or six batters. And after the game, I'm asking, hey, it was control issues. And I can't remember exactly, but I intimated that he was afraid to throw strikes because he was nibbling, and that's why he's walked so many batters. Well, I walked in the clubhouse the next day, and he comes and finds me and says, I'm not scared. I've been in the big league. Oh, yeah. And he just goes off, I'll kill you. I mean, he's like, I'm like, oh, he's sad. I mean, and Canseco's holding me back. I mean, it was a big brouhaha. I left it. I went to Kennedy's house. I was like, what's up with your boy? He walked all those guys. You told me he was scared. Nah. He goes, yeah, but you can't really write that he's scared. You have to find another way to write it because he's, you know, he's a guy. He's a man. That was a big one for baseball. I had another one for football that ended up being written about in the alternative newspaper because I take some responsibility for this one. I was doing one of those mid-season reports, and it was based off of you earned your money, you didn't earn your money, you should get a raise, you should give your salary back, and then you stick a guy's name in there with some comments. Now, the good thing is I did it, and this is when you really had access. I literally called Jerry Jones and said, hey, Jerry, here's my list. What do you think? He said, sounds pretty good to me. And when I got ready to turn it in, I looked at it and I said, you know what? There's no surprises on here at all. This is exactly what everybody would think. I go, that's kind of boring. So I moved a couple things. I said, at least now it'll be interesting. Well, one of them I moved was like Roy Williams should like give his salary to charity. Well, of course, that didn't go over well.
Right.
And so they took a Polaroid of me and they stuck it on the middle of a pole in the middle of the locker room. Because I was like, what are you taking this picture for? And a couple guys just laughed and ran off. And the next day I walked in and they had this letter about I was a, you know, several. I mean, you couldn't put that letter up now because there was several homophobic references to me and all this other stuff. You know, I said, the bottom line was, I said, you know, none of you punks signed this letter. I said, I put my name on everything I write. I'm running around here hiding. And back then, I don't think they were any good. And I said, with your bad record. So, you know, it's all good. But if you do it long enough, man, it's going to happen. So you just got to ride with it and ride it on out.
Well, listen, first of all, the timing for this book could not be better. It's one of the best time books. This is rivals. Mirren Fader wrote a Giannis biography that came out as they Milwaukee was winning the finals. That's the best time book I've ever seen. This has got to be a close second. And it's a great read. I'm a fan of your work for a long time. And thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
All right, brother. I appreciate you.
I want to thank today's guest, Jean-Jacques Taylor, for joining me on Two Writers Singing Yang. You can follow Jacques on Twitter at JJT_journalist and buy Coach Prime wherever books are sold. If you have a chance and enjoy Two Writers Singing Yang, please go to the vehicle of your choice and leave a nice review. I'd be really appreciative. Music is by the momentous MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me. And remember, keep writing.